Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In the spring of a group of California-bound settlers set out from Springfield, Illinois, to find a better life in America's vast and open West. But they were trapped in a snowstorm in the Sierra Nevada mountains. They found themselves without the means to survive the harsh weather. By the time the last member reached safety 6 months later, nearly half of these people had died. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will look back to one of the great tragedies, perhaps one of the best-known tragedies, of America's pioneering past. And it is the story of the Donner Party. And our guest for the program is Ethan Rarick, and we'll be talking about a book that he's authored about what happened with the Donners. The title of his book is Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey West. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Ethan Rarick has written about politics, crime, business, and sports throughout the West. His work has appeared in many publications, including the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. He's also the author of California Rising, The Life and Times of Pat Brown. He is now the acting director of the Center on Politics and also acting director of publications for the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome, certainly, from people who are listening. We just ask people to keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Ethan Rarick, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. This is a story that has held and captivated people forever, from the time that it was big news, when it really was news, to the present day. It's something about it really catches and holds people's imagination. What is it, do you think, about this story that that has had that effect on people?
Well, I think it's two things, really. First of all, it's just a great story, a difficult story, a gripping story, a hard story in many of its details, as we all know. But it's also just an amazingly dynamic story that shows people in many different respects. There is heroism, there is cowardice, there is self-sacrifice, there is selfishness. There's sort of the whole panoply of human behaviors and human emotions. So first of all, it's just a great story. But more important than that, really, is that it involves regular people. So many stories of survival or exploration involve military parties or explorers or people sent out on Victorian expeditions. And they're stories about people who have prepared for those sorts of adventures, people who entered into them willingly just for the sake of having the adventure. And those are wonderful stories, and they have much to teach us. But the Donner Party is really a story of just families searching for a better life, as you said, and that's exactly right. These were families, children, husbands and wives, and they are regular people. They weren't explorers. They weren't people who were trained to do any of this. And they get out there, and they have to survive. And I think that allows us all to kind of relate to them, to think, what would we do in this kind of circumstance, because they were just regular people like us.
Yeah. We certainly should not in any way minimize how difficult a trip this would have been to undertake at the time.
Oh, no.
At the same time, a lot of people did it and managed to get there. So I suppose that over time, the people have said, well, this somehow must reflect badly on these people. That is, maybe they didn't know what they were doing. There may indeed have been some bad choices that were made along the way. Some people have said, well, a lot of other people made the trip, and the fact that these people were failed and so many of them died was somehow their fault.
Yeah, I certainly don't think that it was really their fault. First of all, you're right that a lot of people made the trip and made it safely. It was an incredibly dangerous thing to do. You were setting out basically to walk from the Midwest. Most people jumped off, to use the phrase of that day. They left sort of their known world in Independence, Missouri, and you were walking or maybe riding a horse for 2,000 miles. So it was an incredibly dangerous journey, and you were racing against time because you had to leave early in the spring and get there before the next winter. But having said that, many, many people did it and survived. The story of the Donner Party isn't really typical of the Western migration. It's most atypical. It's the worst story that comes out of the whole migration. And over the course of 20 years, including the Gold Rush, about 250,000 people went west overland. So it certainly isn't typical. But at the same time, I don't think that the fact that it's atypical reflects something that the Donner Party did wrong or reflects some fault of theirs. They made some bad choices. They took a shortcut that, frankly, or what they thought was a shortcut that, frankly, they shouldn't have taken. They definitely made some bad choices. But having said that, mostly they were just trapped by bad luck. It was an early snowstorm that year. They were behind. They were trailing the rest of the migration, but not terribly far behind. There were just a series of things that caused them to fall a little bit farther and farther behind, and then they had the bad luck of this early snowstorm.
Yeah.
So
well,
I don't blame them at all. In fact, I find them all actually, well, not all of them, but I find most of them very inspiring people.
As you say, the people who made this trip or knew anything about it knew that you had to leave early enough so that you didn't have problems with the weather because it was a long, long way. It seems that they were even late jumping off. And so one wonders what happened there at the very beginning, that if they had managed to start and make good progress a week earlier, it could have been a matter of days, and that could have made the difference between making it through and surviving and half the people dying.
Yes, and at the end, they come within a day or a few days of making it. They have to get over the Sierra Nevada and down into California. They were heading for Sutter's Fort, what is today Sacramento, California, and they were approaching the top of the pass for the Sierra. Had they reached the pass, gotten down, started heading down, they might have made it. They might have been trapped on the western slope, but they might have made it down, and the snowstorm comes and traps them. So they were literally within days. And you're right, at the beginning, they were already running a little bit behind. Most of the emigrants had jumped off from Independence and had started out, and they had to catch up. That gave them less time to rest their animals there in Independence. So almost from the beginning, they were running behind. But again, any one of the things that delays them along the route independently wouldn't be enough to really stop them. It's this accumulation of little things that keep pushing them back, and then particularly this ill-fated decision to take what they thought was a shortcut. All those things push them behind, and ultimately, that means they ran out of time.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really incredible about the story when you think about it. You think about the fact this is a 2,000-mile trip and that they managed to get within, I think, is it about a... They were about 130 miles from Sacramento. They were that close to being where they were trying to get?
Yes, about 100 miles more or less. They weren't going exactly straight. But anyway, yeah, roughly 100 miles out of a 2,000-mile trip. So they had virtually completed the whole thing. And if they had reached the top of the mountains, and they were just within a few miles of the crest of the Sierra, if they had reached the top of the mountains and started down the other side, who knows, they might have been able to get through those last miles. The last 50 miles, they would have been out of the snow, and that would have been relatively easy. So they were so close, and yet they didn't make it.
Our guest in this hour, Ethan Rarick, he has authored a book about the Donner Party and their perilous journey west. The title of his book is Desperate Passage. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And it's out now. If you have interest, you pick up the book and take a look at it. And if you have questions, you can call in. We do have a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sorry if I called in a little bit too early. But
no, that's fine.
I just wanted to share with your guest. A few years ago, I took a spring ski trip out to Lake Tahoe and made a side trip to Truckee, California, which I think is just outside of the actually saw the Donner Pass monument, if you will. And it was very interesting. I was amazed, coming from the Midwest, there was a tree, and there was a marking in the tree of where the snow was at the time of the Donner tragedy, and it was measured in feet. I wanted to say something like 15 18 feet off the ground. It was just an amazing amount of snow up in the mountains. Perhaps people from the Midwest, they don't realize, but when you're up there, we went skiing in late May, and there was still plenty of snow up there. My question is, if I recall, there was an American Experience program a few years ago on the Donner family, and I want to say, was there a falling out of some of the members where they had broke up with the party, I want to say in the Great Salt Lake, and departed, and the rest of the party went into the pass, and of course they had the tragedy, but those that left the party actually did find their way to California? I was wondering if there was any truth to that. I'll go ahead and listen off there. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, there were many times throughout the story where components of the party split off and would travel separately for short periods of time. I think what the caller may be referencing is a man named James Reed, who was disliked by some members of the party, could be a little haughty, but was also very much a leader, was the kind of person who took charge and who did what needed to be done and who led others. James Reed, while they were going through what is today Nevada along the Humboldt River, James Reed got into a fight with a teamster for another one of the families. It's unclear exactly what happened, but somehow the other man ended up being killed, and James Reed was banished from the party for killing this other man. Reed then rode ahead, took one of his employees, he had a teamster working for his family, took one of his employees, those two men rode ahead, and they did in fact make it over the pass and into California, and Reed then set about trying to get back and rescue his family and the others, and eventually did return with a rescue party. So Reed and his teamster, James Heron, made it out, made it ahead in time. There was also two other men, one man named Charles Stanton and one man named William McCutcheon, who were at a different point dispatched to go forward and get supplies. They knew that they were running low on supplies. So Stanton and McCutcheon went ahead. They also made it over the pass, made it into California. McCutcheon fell ill and couldn't come back, but Stanton actually did return in an act of great heroism. He didn't have any relatives in the party. He didn't have any family in the party. He was a single man, had no wife or children, but yet he came back because he promised he would come back with these supplies, and then eventually he ultimately did not make it out. He died while trying to escape. So there were those two cases of people who went ahead and made it over the pass and then came back and assisted in the rescue or the survival of the party. But there was no major component of it that broke off and went ahead. I also did want to mention that the caller makes a good point about the amount of snow, because it's hard to understand, unless you've been up there, just how much snow there is. I mean, it gets much colder. I grew up in the Midwest, and it gets much colder in the Midwest. But the amount of snowfall, these storms sponge up moisture out in the Pacific, often out in the Gulf of Alaska, and then blow into California. And the Sierra Nevada are relatively close to the ocean, much closer than most mountains. And so as these storms come in, they're still laden with tremendous amounts of moisture. And as they rise up over the Sierra, they get colder and colder. It begins to snow, and they drop incredible amounts of snow down into this area. You can easily have 15, 20, even 25 feet of snow on the level. That's not a drift. That's just the amount of snow. So you're walking along on top of the snow, and in fact, there can be entire trees underneath you covered in the snow. So it's just it's amazing. And if you're from a part of the country where, as many of these immigrants were, they were from the Midwest. If you're from a part of the country where 3 feet of snow, 4 feet of snow, 5 feet of snow seems like a lot, you have no idea that you're going to get 20 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah, it's one of the ironies, perhaps, of the story is that, well, we call it the Donner Party because the Donner family was one of the founders and one of the leaders, but then there's this other man and his family, James Reed, were also, they're kind of were the co-leaders of the expedition, if you will, and that he was, as you say, he was forced out, made it to California, came back, and when the whole thing was over, he and his family actually stayed with the wagon train when he left, and he and his family, the Reeds, survived, but the Donners didn't.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. It's known as the Donner Party because George Donner was the captain of the party. He was elected captain of the party, but there were many, many other families. And you're right, all the Reeds survived. They were one of only two families to survive intact. And I think people have speculated over the years, had James Reed not been banished from the party, would he have forced them ahead a little faster? Would things have happened differently? Well, it's very hard to know. They were already late at that point, so it's difficult to know. But certainly Reed was a born leader and had many positive qualities.
Yeah. Let's talk with some others. Belgium, next, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. To make a couple of points, if I would. Number one, it's interesting that we here in central Illinois, southern in Illinois, have a connection that the Donner family were a fairly wealthy farm family that came from southern Illinois, I think down near the Robinson area or someplace down through that way. The other point is that, one other point, I have been in Lake Tahoe when it snows at a rate of about 3 inches an hour. So it doesn't take very long for the snow to pile up quick there. In a, overnight, you can easily get 3, 4, 5 feet without any sweat. and huge winds, as we have heard in news here recently in the last couple, 3 weeks. The last point I'd like to make, and which I don't know if we ever think about this very much, we talk about here with the Donner Party, we talk about it with the Mormon migration into Utah. Everybody talks about what a treacherous and horrible trip it was across the American Great Plains. But, you know, there were peoples of the various Indian nations that made that trip all the time. They would walk back and forth, but they knew how to do it. They would go at times when they wouldn't be in trouble. They knew where to go and what paths to take and stuff like that. And the last point I'd like to point out is that if you take I-80 across the United States, you essentially go across Donner Pass. You go past Donner Lake, past Truckee, and also the Union Pacific Railroad also comes back across the Donner Pass. So it must have been a convenient way to go. You just had to know when to do it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If you drive I-80, you will be you are remarkably close to the route of the overland migration, not just when you go over Donner Pass, but throughout Utah, throughout Nevada, and then on into California. I-80 still to this day follows the route very closely. And you're right, the railroad was built right over the pass. In fact, one of the interesting things, we know so much about the weather at Donner Pass, and we know so much about the snow accumulation because the Southern Pacific kept weather records there, reaching all the way back to 1870 when the railroad started running over. So we have better records of snowfall and so forth for Donner Pass than we do for the rest of the Sierra because the railroad was there. So to this day, you can follow the route more or less anyway, very easily by just driving I-80. And it's an excellent point about Native Americans too. Not only did they sort of make this trip, but in fact, they lived in these areas. Indians were, they knew what they were doing. They knew how to survive in those areas. In what is today Nevada, along the Humboldt River, the overland emigrants looked down upon the Indians. They referred to them as diggers because they thought they were just sort of debased people who dug in the ground to find food and so forth, and they thought they were living a very uncivilized life. In fact, the Indians in that area were, they knew how to survive. They knew how to find food by digging for roots. They knew how to build shelters. They knew how to survive through the winter. They lived there. They didn't merely go through and come back or anything, but that was their home, and they knew what they were doing. But again, the people in the Donner Party had none of that knowledge, had none of those ideas, didn't understand how to survive in this area they were going through. There were even Indians, actually, who were near what we today call Donner Lake, what was then called Truckee Lake, where they spent the winter, where they were trapped. At one point in the winter, a lone Indian comes fairly close to the encampment. He's actually seen by a member of the Donner Party, and he leaves them some roots, trying to give them some kind of food, presumably. So there were Indians who were nearby who were surviving throughout the winter and surviving much better than the members of the Donner Party, but the members of the Donner Party just didn't have the knowledge to do that.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller and go on. We have someone next in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Hi. I have a several-part question. What I remember reading about this story when I was very young, maybe in middle school, it's something that everybody covers, and I remember an allusion to cannibalism that maybe potentially went on or did go on. I was wondering if that occurred, and if it did, were these people considered heroes for surviving this ordeal, or villainized, like the Argentinian rugby players who landed in Chile from the book Alive, were actually jailed for having eaten other people to survive? And lastly, if this sort of thing was going on, are there other instances where it's happened in the past? Is the Donner Party exclusively the only people who were ever trapped in this sort of situation, or was this a more common occurrence? And I'll get off the line. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the question. Well, this seems to be one of the aspects of this story that people just can't, you know, can't quite get enough of, or the extreme hardship and what people resorted to survive. That's part of the thing that really grabs people and has always grabbed people about this story.
Of course. It's sort of the headline of the story. And the simple answer is yes, there was cannibalism. There was there were several instances of cannibalism. Once the main party was trapped, it begins to, at that point, it begins to break into pieces. There was a group of 15 members who actually managed at one point, after they were trapped, to hike over the mountains and reach safety. The people were actually trapped, the main members of the Donner Party were trapped at two different camps about 6 or 7 miles apart. So the story is a little bit fragmented, and there was cannibalism at various components or at various times throughout the story. The first instance was when those 15 members broke away from the camps, decided they would try to walk over the mountains. They did make it. It took them a month, which is just unimaginable that they were out there wandering through the Sierra Nevada for a month in the dead of winter. But anyway, while they were walking over the mountains, they were trapped roughly Christmas Day, actually, in 1846. They were trapped by a blizzard out in the open. People began to die. They had no food at all, and they resorted to cannibalism. And then later at the camps, people also resorted to cannibalism. Were they considered heroes or villains? Well, initially, many of the press reports painted them as villains. There were press reports of ghoulish behavior, people eating human flesh when there was other food available, people behaving in odd ways. There was one story of a woman getting up and dancing and then dropping dead. There were all sorts of strange stories that worked their way into various kinds of accounts in newspapers and elsewhere. So initially they were portrayed as ghouls who had resorted to this horrible practice. But over time that really sort of melted away, and people began to see them instead as heroes. And I agree with the second view. People began to see them as heroes who had done what they had to do to survive. And so by the time the monument, one of the callers mentioned the monument at Truckee Lake, which is still there, by the time the monument was erected in the early part of the 20th century, they were hailed as people who reflected all that was best about the overland migration, courage and commitment and dedication and the willingness to do what was necessary to survive. So over time, and fairly quickly, over a matter of a few decades, they came to be seen more as heroes than as villains. The caller also asked about other incidents of cannibalism, and that's a wonderful question because it was something that I didn't know about and that I found very interesting. The fact is that in the 19th century, cannibalism was, I don't want to say accepted, but it was not unheard of, particularly among sailors. People during shipwrecks would be lost at sea for weeks or even months. They'd be out in lifeboats. There was no way to get rescue. There were obviously no radios, no beacons, no helicopters, no planes. You could just be floating around for months out in a lifeboat somewhere. And it was accepted that if that was the case and you had no other way to survive, you resorted to cannibalism. Cannibalism was referred to as the custom of the sea because it was so common for sailors to resort to it. So it was not regarded as some an extraordinary event, but it was not regarded as something horrible to do if you had to do it to survive. In fact, it was even thought that if you had to take a lottery and the loser of the lottery would be killed and then eaten, that was acceptable so long as it was a fair lottery. And it was very, very uncommon that anybody was ever charged with a crime. So in the context of the day, an era in which people could be lost for months at a time, the idea of resorting to cannibalism was certainly not unheard of.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champagne in line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered, he's already I forget what the guest's name is, but he's already alluded to the delay that the Donner Party took breaking trail through Utah. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, and also if you have anything to say about the ramifications for the pioneers that came the next year and settled in Utah. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I think that you talked earlier about the fact that there were little things that happened all the way along to slow them down. But the big turning point seemed to be the the alleged shortcut that they decided to take that turned out to be a big mistake.
Yes, that was definitely the biggest component. The shortcut was designed, or again, so-called shortcut, I guess I should say, was designed or thought up by a man named Lansford Hastings. Lansford Hastings was a young lawyer from Ohio who had gone west. He was a self-promoter. He was kind of he hoped to be a real estate developer in California. There is some evidence, although it's unclear, but there is some evidence that he might even have thought that perhaps California would break away from, it was still at that point Mexican territory, but would break away from Mexico and become an independent republic, would not join the United States, but would become like Texas, an independent country, and that perhaps somehow he would end up as president of California. The evidence for that is very mixed. But anyway, he was definitely sort of a man on the make. And he developed the idea that you could go south of the Great Salt Lake. The traditional trail actually went sort of out of the way. Once you got across the Rocky Mountains, everybody went across the Rocky Mountains at what's called South Pass, which is in the middle of Wyoming. And that was the easiest way to get over the Rocky Mountains. So that you had to go to South Pass. Once you got over South Pass, the traditional trail then went south, a little farther south in Wyoming, and then you went out of your way. You went north up into what is today Idaho at Fort Hall, what is today Pocatello, Idaho, and then you turned south and you went back south. So you went well out of your way, much farther north than you needed to go, and then you turned back south to go into California. Lansford Hastings had the idea that if you just went straight across, once you got to Fort Bridger in southern Wyoming, you'd go south of the Great Salt Lake, you'd cross the Great Salt Lake Desert, and then you'd meet up again with the traditional trail. And it's true that it looked straighter. If you just look at a map, it seems to be very straight. The problem was you had to go across the Wasatch Mountains, and then you had to go across the Great Salt Lake Desert, which is a horribly desiccated, dry, impossible, difficult area. To this day, there's nothing out there. And so going straight, which sounded like a great idea, proved to be a horrible idea because of these two natural impediments. The Donner Party was actually warned about this trip. When they got to Wyoming, they encountered a man named James Clyman, an old mountain man. He was actually an old acquaintance of James Reed, the man we talked about earlier. He and Reed talked, and Clyman, who had just traveled this shortcut with Lansford Hastings, told him, don't take it. It's more difficult than the regular trail. It may be shorter, but it's harder to travel on. Go by the stick with the traditional trail. Reed, for whatever reason, ignored that advice. He at least played some role, we know, in encouraging the Donner Party to take this shortcut. Others presumably agreed. He didn't have any ability to force anybody, so I don't blame Reed entirely. But by whatever decision, they made a decision they would try the shortcut. And that shortcut proved to be horrible. They had to hack their own trail through the Wasatch Mountains, a particularly steep and forbidding range. Across the Great Salt Lake Desert, they had no water. Many of their animals ran away. Some of them had to abandon some of their wagons. By the time they rejoined the traditional trail in Nevada, they were really a threadbare group. They had lost any cohesion they had. They were physically damaged by this shortcut, and worst of all, they had just lost a lot of time. Roughly speaking, you can estimate, looking at other groups that went by the traditional trail, they probably lost about 3 weeks. So that's by far the biggest component of their falling behind, and that's the biggest single mistake they made. Again, I think they should have, given this warning, I think they should have known not to take it. But I don't want to be overly fierce in blaming them. I mean, the whole enterprise was a dangerous thing to set out for this new life. They were gutsy people to even try at all, and timid people were still back on the farm. So it's easy to look back now and blame them, but they were taking a gamble from the beginning, and they took a gamble on this shortcut.
Yeah, you'd sort of wonder whether it's at one point on the shortcut when things were looking really tough, if anybody said, you know, maybe we should just turn around and go back to Fort Bridger and maybe even sit there. Now, maybe that would not have been an option, just to sit there and wait out the winter and start again in the spring.
They could have tried that. I mean, there were certainly people living at Fort Bridger, so they could have tried to wait it out there. They certainly could have gone back early on in the shortcut when they sort of first got to the Wasatch Mountains, and they found Hastings was supposed to wait for them and guide them, and he didn't. He went ahead with an earlier party, and they rode ahead. Reed and two other men rode ahead and found him and said, hey, come back and guide us. And Hastings said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stick with these folks. at that point, one might have thought they would have thought about turning around, going back to Fort Bridger and going by the traditional trail. But again, I think they should have done that, and I'm sure in retrospect they probably thought they should have done that. But the whole thing was a risk. They were taking a risk to begin with, and for whatever reason, they decided to go ahead and try this shortcut. But that was the single biggest component of delay, and it was the single biggest component that ended up trapping them out there in the mountains.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Ethan Rarick. He is the acting director of the Center on Politics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also acting director of publications for the Institute of Governmental Studies. He's been a journalist and has covered politics in both California and Oregon for more than 15 years. He's written for the Associated Press, UPI, the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle. He's author of the book California Rising, The Life and Times of Pat Brown, and a new book just recently published by the Oxford University Press that tells this story. His book is Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey West. Number for people who like to call in here, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Maybe it's taking a step back here a little bit, but I'm thinking about the fact that I mentioned, and then a caller again mentioned the fact that a lot of these people, at least the Donners and the Reeds, were from Illinois. And this trip actually started from Springfield. Who were these people? What kind of folks were they?
Well, the Donners, there were actually two Donner families. George Donner, who became the captain of the party, giving it its name, and his brother. So there were two Donner families. They were both farm families from Springfield, from around Springfield. They were prosperous farmers, not enormously wealthy, but certainly not poor, and that was pretty typical of the overland migration. Generally speaking, it took money to go west. You had to buy gear and equipment. You had to be without an income for 6 months. You had to have enough money to set up a new farm in California or in Oregon. So you couldn't be desperately poor and make this journey. But on the other hand, if you were terribly rich, you probably didn't make it either. And the Donner families were typical of that. They were not poor, not wealthy, but they were fairly affluent. The Reed family, the other family from Springfield, James Reed was a businessman. He had grown up as a fatherless child. His father had died young, and he had always been a real go-getter, a real energetic sort of guy, and he'd moved through a whole series of businesses, furniture manufacturing, all sorts of different businesses, and had prospered as a merchant. Again, not exactly the kind of background that gives one great training for survival in the mountains of the West, but it allowed him to have enough money to make this journey and to seek out a better life. And this is something that I find very admirable about these families in a way. These were people who were not fleeing poverty. They had perfectly decent lives, and yet they still had the gumption and the courage to get up and try to move west in search of something better still. So it's extraordinary in a way that here they were people who had fairly comfortable lives, and yet they were so determined to try to find something a little bit better that they wanted to move on. All three of these families, the two Donner family and the Reed family, as you said, were from Springfield, Illinois. Reed had actually fought with Abraham Lincoln in the Black Hawk War about 10 years earlier. He and James Clyman, the man I mentioned earlier, who warned Reed about the shortcut, had both been in Lincoln's company. They knew him. We don't know that they were great friends or anything, but they mustered in on the same day. There's a muster roll with their names coming in on the same day. Clyman said later, "We never thought at that time about Lincoln becoming president of the United States." So there's definitely an Illinois connection to this story.
For a long time, I guess the all one would have to try to put together the story of what happened, particularly there at the point where they were trapped, would have come from survivors and their accounts of what they had been through. Now, more recently, we have the opportunity to, and people have gone through that area and used modern archaeological techniques to try to examine what is there now to be seen, what you can find, and how that also has a story to tell. Have there been some things now that, based on that kind of evidence, that we have learned that gives us perhaps a better picture of what happened at that point in the story, better than the accounts that had been left behind by the people who had been there and had actually survived the experience?
Well, most of the best details, really, to be honest, still come from the accounts of survivors, and they left a pretty rich record. They wrote a lot of letters. They wrote journals. One man, Patrick Green, kept a diary during the months of their entrapment. That's just an extraordinary document. So to this day, really, the best details come from the survivors. But it is true that archaeology over the last 20 years has definitely given us some new insights. In the 1990s, the camp where the two Donner families camped over the winter, was actually located. We pretty much knew where it was, but there had always been some disputes about it. That camp was essentially located, for all practical purposes, we knew where it was based on the archaeological record. More recently, just within the last few years, an archaeological team looked for evidence of cannibalism at that particular camp. They looked for pieces of bone that had markings of either butchering or cooking, and they didn't find that. Now, whether that suggests that there wasn't cannibalism or not is disputed. For various reasons, the bones of people who had been cannibalized probably would have disintegrated by now. They would exist only if those bones had been cooked, and that's something that usually happens only at the very end of cannibalism. People usually eat the flesh, and then only at the very last period of cannibalism will they actually cook the bones. So it certainly it doesn't mean that there was no cannibalism at that camp, but it did throw into doubt some of the claims of cannibalism at that particular camp. Now, I hasten to add, there's no question of cannibalism in the story of the Donner Party. At other points in the story, there's no question that cannibalism occurred at other locations because survivors said we resorted to cannibalism. But that sort of threw open interest in this story again as to exactly what happened. So it's possible that there will be future findings and something more definitive. But for now, the archaeology has certainly given us some new insights, and yet really, when you get right down to it, the best details and the best observations still come from the survivors.
Yeah. For those people who did survive, was their survival, was it a matter of luck? Was it that they just happened to be some of the strongest people? Were particular reasons that the people that survived did survive?
Well, this is something that's fascinating, and this is an area where modern research has really cast some light on things. First of all, women survived much more than men. That was noticed almost right away, that women survived at a much greater rate than men did. And more recently, in the 150 years since the Donner Party, we now have come to understand that there are good biological reasons for that. Women, as a rule, have a higher percentage of body fat than men. As the body begins to consume itself, women can draw on the fat reserves they have. Men more quickly begin to draw on muscle. And so women are more naturally biologically equipped to survive slow starvation. It's also true that since women are smaller, they generally need fewer calories. So the men needed to eat more, and when the body began to consume itself, they began to consume valuable muscle faster. So for biological reasons, we now understand that women were more likely to survive, and in fact, women did survive in much greater rates than men. Secondly, age played a crucial factor. The very young and older people did not generally survive. Very few children under 5 survived, and very few adults over 40 survived. In fact, of the adults over 40, only two adults, the one couple, Patrick Breen and his wife Peggy Breen, they are the only people over 40 who survived, and they had a larger supply of meat at the beginning of the winter than anybody else. So they benefited from that. But generally speaking, the very young died and the older people died. And then perhaps most interesting of all, of the people in their 20s, those who were without families, and mostly these are single men who were working as teamsters, they were working for some of the families driving the wagons, the single men died. That has something to do undoubtedly with the fact they were men. I mentioned earlier that women survived. But it also has to do with the fact that they had no family ties. People with family ties in the party survived at much greater rates than those who were alone. And we now know from a whole variety of studies in the last 100 years since the Donner Party that social ties are good for people, that people with social networks and social ties survive difficult ordeals at much greater rates than those people who do not have family members present. There was a fascinating study done of prisoners in Andersonville, the notorious Confederate prison camp during World War II, that found that men who were imprisoned with friends or brothers or even just people from their own hometown survived at a greater rate than those who were imprisoned without anybody they knew. So human beings are social creatures. They need other people to survive, and the Donner Party really shows that. Almost all of the single men who were in their 20s, presumably the best physical shape of their lives, died, and the women who were in their 20s almost all lived. So you can, by looking at these modern studies and applying them to the Donner Party, you can really see that there were several factors going on in who survived, but the most important ones probably were women survived more than men, people who were not terribly young or not terribly old survived more than little children or older people, and then people who had family members, somebody to spur them on, to give them emotional sustenance, to give them a reason to live, they survived more than people who were alone.
Yeah. Forgive me, I think you said Andersonville was a World War II prison camp.
It was the Civil War.
Yeah. Yes. A little bit before that.
Yes.
And, well, you know, that's really interesting. And do you think that it has something to do with the fact that people who have family ties are more likely to take care of each other, or that it is something that's more of an emotional kind of a thing, and that it means that people have emotional support, or perhaps they feel that they have a greater will to survive because they're somehow our family members there. And if one is alone, that it's somehow, well, you feel as if you're alone.
Right. I think it's both. I think that your family members are more likely to give you food or to help you do chores or to help shovel the snow off the cabin in the case of the Donner Party, to do whatever needs to be done. But I also think there's a tremendous role that this kind of emotional sustenance plays, that it gives you a reason to live. If you have a spouse or a child or a parent or a sibling who's there, you are inspired to try to live for that person. You're receiving their care and concern. And if you're alone, it's easier to just sort of lose hope, to give up and die. One young man who was in his 20s and who died, James Reed wrote later of him, he did not starve, he just gave up and pined away. Hmm. He just died, didn't starve. There was still food at that point. So I think it's just easier to lose hope if you're alone.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Actually, maybe more, about 5 or 6 minutes left in this hour of focus with Ethan Rarick. He's author of the book Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey West, published by the Oxford University Press, just out. And it is indeed the story of this group of people that set out from Springfield, Illinois, and got caught there unexpectedly by a really bad snowstorm. And many of them died. Some of them indeed did make it. And it's maybe one of the most famous stories, certainly the most famous story of tragedy of the westward migration. 333-9455 is the number if you'd like to give us a call. Toll free, 800-222-9455. There were, once the people got stuck there were a couple of times when groups of people tried to get over the mountains. And in fact, some people, I think, actually did make it. Did that make sense? Would it have made more sense for everybody just to sit there and wait for rescue? Or is that idea, did they have to know that unless they made some sort of effort to rescue themselves, that they would likely simply have been lost and eventually everybody would die?
Well, in retrospect, one thing that might have made sense actually is to turn around and to go back a few miles. They had been gaining elevation as they got to Truckee Lake. Had they gone back only as far as modern-day Reno, which is not terribly far, they could have made it in a few days. Reno is at a much lower elevation than Donner Lake is, and they would have had much less snow. It would have certainly been cold, but much less snow. They would have probably had an easier chance of surviving through the winter. They could have hunted a little easier. In retrospect, it might have made sense. But at the time, they kept thinking that the snow will melt off, they'll get a break in the storms, they'll be able to get over the mountains. They never really fully accepted that they were stuck there for the whole winter. And in fact, ultimately, one of the groups did make it over. There was this group of 15 people, later it can be known as the Forlorn Hope. They didn't call themselves that at the time, but they've gone down in history as the Forlorn Hope. they managed to walk over the mountains to find their way down to settlements on the western side of the Sierra. They didn't know where they were going, so this is extraordinary. The only people who knew where they were going were Charles Stanton, the man who'd gone ahead and come back with supplies. He died relatively early in this journey. And then two Indians who had come back with him from Sutter's Fort, they weakened until they were probably going to die anyway, and then they were murdered to be eaten as food. So at the end, there was nobody there who knew where they were going. They managed somehow to stagger down until they got to some Indian villages on the western side. The Indians then helped them, and they went ahead and managed to reach the first American settlement on the western side of the Sierra, a place called Johnson's Ranch. And ultimately, that did actually summon help. It was the word then of the Forlorn Hope that there is still a party trapped in the mountains that caused the rescue efforts to begin. James Reed had gone ahead, but he mistakenly thought, it was understandable at the time, but he thought that the party still had a large supply of cattle. In fact, many of their cattle had been killed by Indians in what is today Nevada. So he didn't really realize how desperate they were. When the members of the Forlorn Hope got down to the American settlements, they could tell people, we have no food up there, it's a truly desperate situation, and we need rescue. So on the one hand, it would have made sense for them not only to stay where they were, but to actually have retreated and spent an easier winter. On the other hand, the fact that they did go ahead and try to get out and ultimately did make it over is one of the things that actually summoned help.
For those people who survived, was this, well, I would imagine that this was an experience that would mark the rest of their lives forever after, and in a sense define them. Was that the case? And were these people that were known to be Donner survivors of this party, or did they just simply go on to live their lives and didn't really make a lot of that?
Well, it was a mix. There were some who never quite shook it off. There were some who lived difficult lives who, looking back now, we can say that they probably suffered from some sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome. There was one woman who would break into tears whenever it was mentioned. There was one woman who, the first book about the Donner Party was written about 30 years later. There was one woman who did not want to be mentioned, wrote back to the author saying, I don't want to have anything to do with this. So there were those who clearly kept it at arm's length and had a difficult time with it. Most of them, however, went on to lead perfectly successful, normal, happy lives. They got over it. They were prominent people in the community. A number of people went on to prominence in California. And generally speaking, they went on and lived their lives and were just fine. There was one man, Louis Kiesberg, who was the last man taken down. He was there. He had been injured. He'd injured his foot, and so he couldn't go out with the initial rescue parties. He was up there until April. He was the last man alive. When the last rescue party got there, nobody else was alive. And Kiesberg was always suspected of having killed a woman named Tamsin Donner to eat her because they found him up there by himself surviving on human flesh. I don't think he did kill her, and there was never really any evidence of that, but he became known as kind of the ghoul of the Donner Party, and he became sort of cursed for the rest of his life because nobody would forgive him for his supposedly horrible role in killing this woman and eating her and surviving on human flesh. But generally speaking, people went on and lived lives, and ultimately, ironically, they really found what they were searching for in California, for those who survived, because they really did find better lives.
Mm. It was interesting, and there's a picture here of some of the survivors when the monument was dedicated, so that some of them at least lived to see that event. It looks like here mostly they were elderly women at the time, two Reeds and one Donner, but they were there.
Yes, they were there. It's remarkable how fast things changed. I mean, the Donner Party happened in 1846. The Transcontinental Railroad went through in 1869. So there were plenty of members who were still alive at that point. They could ride the train in perfect comfort over this place, right past this place where they'd been trapped for so many months. So things changed remarkably fast, and they lived to see really a different world.
Yeah. Well, it's a remarkable story, and I appreciate you taking some time to talk, and I'm sure that, it's one of those stories that just, it's now all these many years later, but it still seems to grab people as much as always and probably always did. Maybe it was the key story of just the iconic story about how things can go, and at least for this one group of people did go terribly wrong.
It is. It's kind of the iconic story of the West, not, again, because it's typical, but because it shows, I think, how regular people could sacrifice so much to come to new lives out in the West. So it's become very much an iconic story of the overland migration.
Well, the book is Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey West, published by the Oxford University Press, by our guest, Ethan Rarick. He's the acting director of the Center on Politics at University of California, Berkeley, also acting director of publications for the Institute of Governmental Studies, and has been a journalist and for more than 15 years has covered politics in both California and Oregon. And Mr. Rarick, well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.